Trained Up, a podcast. I am your host, Dave Schell, and I am back with the gravel god himself, Matty Rowe. Matty, thanks for coming back.
My pleasure. Love to be here.
So I recently did a podcast. I don't know if it's published yet. And we were talking about some of the different ways to measure intensity and what the pros and cons of each were. And both myself and Dr. Phil Batterson were kind of adamant about using max heart rate and why you don't want to do it, especially if you're just using one of the general formulas that are out there, such as like 220 minus your age or something like that. You and I have done a few podcasts. We're always, you know, touching base every few months or whatever, just talking about like, what are you up to these days? What are you interested in at the moment? And our recent check-in, you told me that you've started dabbling in training by max heart rate, and it all started with an article that you read. And so you are here today to try to change my mind about max heart rate and why it might be effective or more effective for athletes that want to improve their performance.
It's like the Louder with Crowder meme where he sits at a table. Max heart rate is a good way to measure training intensity, or is not, change my mind.
Yeah, exactly. I used that recently on time to exhaustion. And what a flawed metric it is, but anyway.
Oh boy.
So set this up. What started you down this rabbit hole? What was it that got you thinking about max heart rate? And then how did that kind of evolve over time?
So I got into endurance sports because of cross-country skiing, and I still kind of keep a toe or two in that world and have some athletes that are seasonal, so they'll do some Nordic skiing. And so just by virtue of that, I'm a little bit in that world. And last fall, this professional team in Norway published this paper, and it was disseminated around. It was pretty banger, and headline was provocative. It was, "You're training too hard and will never reach you are training too hard and you will never reach your full potential." So, I mean, that's gold clickbait.
That's clickbait, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I dove in, and it was really, it changed my mind. It was game changing for me. And the reason that I like to pull from Nordic skiing is because, unlike cycling, it doesn't have the same output metrics you can use. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not about, you don't have a power meter. Speed is useless because conditions change so much, whether you're roller skiing or skiing. So how do you guide your training? And this, what they proposed in here was essentially that most people are messing up their training composition for those exact reasons, because they're overestimating their ability and they're training too hard. And they sort of did a review of different ways that you can estimate intensity, and like some more accurate, some less. And they sort of settled on and recommended, based upon working with hundreds of athletes, max heart rate, because it's widely available and it generally solves for the problem of overestimating your abilities and training too hard at the wrong time. And they had a bunch of different groups, and they were pointing out that generally the Nordic skiers who performed the best, it wasn't like one's VO2 max was greater than the other, or their threshold speed necessarily was better, but the training composition, especially in the easy endurance, was much lower than lots of people supposed even counted as really training. And so that perked my ears up, because in my own practice, I've had a couple people who I would say are kind of training maximizers. They're really, really motivated. And so these are the athletes, if there's any other coaches listening, where it's like they get their zones, and whatever you prescribe, it's like, oh, it's zone two. Well, I'm going to max zone two. I'm going to hump the top of that zone because I'm getting more. I'm a zone two maximalist.
Right.
And sometimes they did okay, but largely I would say if you zoom out over the course of the season, we just ran into a lot of, if not like all burnout or inconsistency, just like not as much response or improvement as you might imagine or might hope for. And so just as an experiment, I sort of flipped the switch with a couple athletes, let's call it, right after their off season in November when they sort of returned to training. And I said, hey, toss out, you're not like, I don't even want power on your, I don't want you to see power. We're going to use your heart rate. These are the new zones. And I pulled them based upon the suggestions in this, we'll call it a white paper. And when you do your endurance rides, you don't, you go in this zone, you go by this, you know, train with this span based upon your maximum heart rate achieved in sport, in the modality, on the bike in the past year, the highest that you've achieved. And if you don't have the data there, we can also use this formula.
So first off, I'll be sure to link to the paper in the show notes, but how are you calculating max heart rate? And I know that's always been kind of one of the debates. There's that a lot of people will use a very generic formula. Like one of the most popular ones is 220 minus your age. And in my experience, you know, I have these general rules of thumb where it's like males typically have lower heart rates than females. Bigger people usually have lower heart rates than smaller people. However, I've seen that completely flipped on its head where I have a tiny female athlete that has low heart rates. And then I have a big, like 180 pound male athlete that is hitting 175 for like his threshold work over and over again. And so how, like, if you're actually looking at data, what are your parameters for that? And then how do you verify it?
So it's pretty simple. I would just use a Training Peaks dashboard chart. Make sure that it's, the data's clean. It's not a, you know, it's not some spike. And then I would look at it from the past year and then from previous years and across different sports if there were available. And so I kind of look at the, I think it goes down to 1 second or five, and I would just take the lower number because the bias that I was shooting for, I wasn't as concerned with accuracy. I was concerned with, okay, like I want ballpark because what am I solving for? I'm having top level 80% of the time they're spending the training. My thesis is they're probably doing it too hard for what's actually going to get them to respond better and race to their potential. So if it's lower, you know, F it, like it's going to help me. So, okay. So the zone gets shifted a little bit more to the left. And now instead of 100 beats per minute being the bottom of their, let's call it endurance pace, it's 95 or whatever. Great. Like works for me, solves the same issue. Now, if I didn't have much historical data, then I just used the formula that they provided in the white paper.
And what is the formula?
It's 211 minus 0.64 times age.
Okay. Got it. So do you have an example of what, how old are you and what would that be for you?
37, that would, let's see. Let me just do a quick calculation. I'm sure you can edit this out later. Six.
We edit nothing.
One, six, eight. Okay, so that would peg me. I'm 37. That would peg me at 187 for max, which based on my data is very close. I think I hit 186 or 185 last year once.
Okay. And so this brings up another good point, I think. And this is why I was talking to you before we started recording, where it's like I kind of went down this path at one point. And the reason I stopped using it is what I found was that as athletes were carrying more fatigue, their kind of max heart rate would be a little bit suppressed. And so it's like if I was telling somebody, oh, go do zone two, but don't, or whatever, go do endurance, but don't go over this heart rate, either by pushing a bigger gear, so lower cadence, bigger gear, they could keep their heart rate low, or just by being fatigued, it's like they could be going pretty hard and their heart rate wouldn't get above that cap anyway. So have you dealt with that? And then like, how do you solve for that?
Yes, I have. And the way that it solved actually came to light recently, because I've been pretty annoyed, as most coaches get, with the paucity of feedback and workout comments, and especially the quality. Like, it's pulling teeth to get them, and then sometimes if you get them, you're just not really getting the information you want. So finally, I laid down the law of Gustavo, and I was like, look, every workout, I want four things. I want your workout readiness out of 10, 10 being the best. I want your self-described workout execution out of 10. I want your nutrition, including out of 10, including what you ate and sodium. And then just anything, you know, anything pertinent to the workout or that I should know that would influence how this went. Just anecdote. And that added the context that really made this pretty easy to judge if there was heart rate suppression going on. Because invariably you would see from a subjective standpoint, like, okay, this was endurance ride. Weird, like your workout readiness was a 3. You didn't eat anything. Your self-describe was, you know, sometimes, well, mostly terrible. And then your anecdote was, you know, I got fired or whatever. So that makes it pretty clear, like, you're probably carrying some fatigue, and like, that's what I'm seeing. But also I would say that just from having coached for a long time and getting semi-frequent testing and looking at metrics like EF, so like the power you're getting for every beat, it's pretty rare that, like, 9 times out of 10, if you're seeing an endurance ride and suddenly the EF is just spiking, which is to say that, like, the power they're getting from each heart rate just rockets up, or, you know, whatever, they're in the middle of a tough, like, the context of the week or the block is we're kind of loading, and all of a sudden you're, you know, your heart rate's down, but your power's up. It's like, I'm not seeing that everything is shifted to the right in 3 days suddenly. Like, what I'm seeing is fatigue. So looking at it in isolation, I would be driving blind. But in the context, and especially with the workout comments, I feel like it's pretty clear quickly.
And so what kind of, I mean, I think about this, and there was a thing, it's pretty old. It was Dr. Phil Maffetone, and he had this formula for, like, he would set a heart rate, and it's like, basically, you don't go over this heart rate when you're doing your base training or something like that. And what it resulted in a lot of times was people having to walk up hills because it was so low. And so, one, I'm curious, like, when you're setting these targets for your athletes, is it significantly lower than it would have been previously? And then two, have you gotten pushback from the athletes in the beginning?
Oh, so much pushback. It is so brutal and humbling for a lot of athletes, because it's a lot easier than doing it, for example, by zone 2 power. It's just like endurance. When I say endurance pace now by max heart rate, it's essentially, it feels, and the output is often recovery. And so one of the problems is they do that and they feel like they're not doing anything. But one of the reasons that they feel that way is because of metrics like TSS, which have conditioned them to think that more TSS is always better, or the way you get 100 TSS is the same whether you do it balls out or, you know, 2.5 hours at zone 1 by max heart rate. Except what the study is pointing out, and I'm really starting to believe in, is the training adaptation you're getting from really lowering your endurance pace is basically the same as hugging the top of zone 2 by power, except the fatigue is so much less.
Right.
And so the composition of your training load is such that you're not redlining your, I would call it your training availability. And what can be misleading about that term is that training availability isn't just, I have 168 hours in the week and I have 20 that I can train. Well, that's wrong, because you have to adapt, you have to recover from that. And so that's the true cap on things with your time availability. And the thing is, you might be able to slam in 10 to 15 hours, like always maximizing, but then you are essentially kind of, it's not exactly overtraining. It's just that you're always kind of training to the max, and you're never like giving your body enough of a break or bandwidth to, you're actually like blunting your adaptation from the stress, because you're always riding right to the edge of what you can handle. And then that normalizes and you think this is just normal training. And there's other symptoms of that we can get into. It's a whole other thing. But big picture, athletes that have successfully adopted this and have sort of bought into, okay, I don't need to be a TSS fetishist, especially in my endurance rides, I just find that they respond so much better, and they race so much better. And moreover, I think another part of it is more just their quality of life. Like they have a better mood. They have more energy for the day-to-day stuff. They're not just boxed constantly.
Right.
And you're boxed constantly. Everything, the simplest things start to feel like a real effort, and it shouldn't, in my opinion.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's one, I think it's just part of our culture. It's this idea that if it doesn't hurt, it's not productive. Like it should feel like a challenge. And I think another thing with that is that like people, like you said, it's like it's point of diminishing returns. And so training higher in the zone doesn't necessarily lead to more training stress. It just leads to more fatigue. And so it's really not that beneficial. And I think the other thing that I always think about is productive training. Right? It's like, just because you're adding stress, is it productive stress? Like, or are you just breaking down your body? And ultimately, and I think this is, it's such a simple concept, but we lose sight of it a lot of times. Fitness is not the fatigue. Like it's not when you're out wrecking yourself and just burying yourself. It's the period after it that your body crawls out of that and has to adapt to be more resilient and stuff like that. And so if you're just always riding that edge and never allowing opportunities to adapt and absorb that training, then you're really just burying yourself and making yourself tired.
Yeah, I've given a lot of athletes, I think, some of the coldest showers of their life recently, because I've pointed out that if, like, there's a Goldilocks band of stress, to your point. And so there's, to take it to the extreme, you can sit on the couch and do nothing. So you're not introducing any stress that's adapted to riding but faster. And then there's the other side of it, which is I'm going to, I don't know, ride to Kansas and back today, which is a lot of stress. And most athletes by default think like the more stress, the better. But actually, in my mind, I think both being on the couch and just flogging yourself so much that you go outside the Goldilocks zone are basically equivalent. Because I find that especially when you do that, like the make the devil's bet, like I'm going to do a ton of duration with a ton of intensity, and of course sometimes basically starving themselves, like you think, oh, I'm going to get some signal out of this, but mostly what you end up with is just like 4 days on the couch, probably getting sick, like just. And so net on net, once you back out and you say, okay, you were here, and then because you do this crazy thing, you missed out on this week, and then this week was, so we lost 2.5, almost 3 weeks worth of like consistency and good training. And oh, our testing again here, oh, you didn't improve. I mean, it's so much, but it's so much effort and just burns people so much. But it's like, yeah, it's not like there's a certain adaptive Goldilocks zone that you're going to get something out of, and going either extreme doesn't help you.
You know, there's a, from Joe Frill's book, The Cyclist Training Bible, there's always a quote that I always like, it always stuck with me when I first read it. And it, like, I have always kind of lived by it. and it's do the least amount of training that brings about positive adaptation, right? And I think most athletes don't want to do that. And I like it's been a fight, you know, or been a challenge a lot of times, because it's like people just, I have more time. I can do it. You know, like I can go harder, things like that. And so one, I think there's that, and that kind of speaks to the Goldilocks zone. Now, the other side I would say to this, and I'd be curious to get your input, is I think a lot of athletes train, it's an outlet for them and it's entertainment. And so they want to go hard. They want to like bury themselves because they had a rough day at work or something like that. And so I'm curious, in the athletes you've tried it with, one, you said they're pretty top level. So like, what are their goals and stuff like that? And do you have athletes on the other side that maybe only have, you know, 6 to 8 hours a week to train, and it's more about personal best and stuff for them and completing like a bucket list race? Like, are you trying the same approach with them, and how's that worked?
Well, so I always try to keep top of mind, like the coach's central role, which I feel like is, and I hate this word, but like compassion and accountability. So I'll start with the thing I like the most, accountability. Like if you come to me and you say, hey, I want to get whatever, top 50 at Unbound, and this is the most important to me, I'll say, okay, look, this is I think the path. You said you have this availability, this parameter, like this is what I think you need to do realistically to have a shot at that. And as long as I'm pretty happy with them if they're pursuing that in good faith. But I think a lot of times what happens is people have these like low resolution goals, but then in the application of their training, I see something else. They're solving for something else. And mostly what I see there, which is sometimes where the compassion comes in, and that's my work because I don't do that enough, is the going hard too much, is the ego stuff, is the stuff in it. And that used to frustrate me, but I've had a lot of, I think my life's been better, is that I just call it out and I don't throw judgment on it. And I'm just like, but it's your choice. Because one thing that I've really come around to is, look, at the end of the day, I think because I'm trying to program and maximize for your goals and your performance, I think that's why you're turning pedals. But there's many other things too. This is a stress relief. This is how you have your fun, blah, blah, blah. You want to be crazy. We're all human, and you're probably not getting paid to do this. So, okay. Like I have to just allow for that. One thing that I call it, you have to let your athletes have their vodka. And the reason I get that is from this nutritional course. And they were talking about this fighter that came to a coach. And he's like, hey, I got to make race weight. I've got this much time. I'll do anything you ask. But just so you know, I won't do it if you don't let me get drunk once a week. And the coach was like, what? And he's like, yep, that's my only contingency. And the coach was like, all right. You wouldn't consider not? And he's like, that's what it is. So they folded that into the plan. So essentially, I'm finding with every athlete, every athlete has their vodka. I'm not saying it's vodka. Right. That's just, I just know that basically every 1 to 2 weeks, I'm just going to see something that isn't, we'll call it textbook to the goal. I call it out, but I'm not like, I'm going to fire you or I can't stand coaching. It's just, it is what it is. And I get that. So.
No. And I think just to go stay on this topic of compassion a little bit more. Yeah. I think it's super important, and there's athletes in the past, and I've had this conversation a lot of times where it's, you know, they've got high goals and we discuss like, okay, well, what are you willing to sacrifice or what? And everybody has that line, and I can't determine what that line is for you. And so as an example, it might be like, oh, are you willing to stop drinking? Are you willing to stop going out with your friends? Are you going to go to bed at 8 PM every night? Like, it's your goal, it's your choice. I can't make those for you, but like you said, everybody's going to have that, those things they're not willing to give up. And I think the other important piece of this is just having that conversation with the athlete. And like you said, it's, you have that discussion, you say, from my point of view, this is what I see, this is what I think would be beneficial. Now you have that knowledge, you can still make your own decision, but at least we had the discussion. And it's like, okay, so maybe your result won't be as optimal as it could have been, but you probably had more fun getting there than you would have otherwise if you had to like stick to this exactly, you know?
Yeah. And I think to fold it back into the max heart rate thing, and just, and I would say the biggest thing is, one of the biggest things I've noticed is with like lowering what qualifies as adaptive stress for endurance pace, I think one of the freeing things for a lot of people is they realize that it's actually so much easier than they thought to ride at that pace, that they just, it just like infuses training with a little bit of levity. Like you don't have to be clinching all the time. You can sort of relax. You can, you know, you can, every ride doesn't have to be maxing out whatever you're supposed to do. And that just makes them a lot happier. And I actually think that applies to lots of things. So a lot of time when we talk about, we're trying to inform the sacrifice it takes to achieve a goal. Yeah, there's some sacrifices involved, but I think from my own personal coaching perspective, I'm coming around to the notion that you don't have to be so perfect and so dialed, and that just giving them, following the Joe Friel thing, like, giving them a lesser dose, like you'd be surprised what people can do. And you're looking at it on paper and they're like, I don't know. It's going to be tight. Like, I don't know if we've done enough homework. People are surprising, especially if on average, they're not training in a way where they're just grasping and scraping by.
Yeah. And I mean, that's something I've kind of operated on for a long time. And I think I came to this realization through a couple of different ways. And one is like, I started traveling a lot for work and it used to really stress me out. Like, oh, I'm missing all this training and I would be gone, you know, for 2 weeks or whatever. And then I'd come back and I'd like feel like crap for a couple of days and then I'd race. And like my performance really wasn't that much different than it would have been if I would have trained those 3 weeks or whatever. And so I realized there's a lot more flexibility in things, and like it doesn't have to be quite as rigid. And I'm like a big fan of the Pareto principle, and that like 80% of our results comes from 20% of the inputs. And so as long as you can do the foundational things, the basic things really well, you're probably going to get 80% of the way there. And then, yeah, if you're like trying to win nationals, trying to go to the Olympics, things like that, then that's where you really have to dial in and start to focus on those marginal gains. But for the vast majority of people, it doesn't have to be that rigid.
Yeah. Preach. I mean, I almost want to do, I have to obtain so much permission, but just the racing team that I'm on, I have some of their Training Peaks accounts and many of them have sort of retired, so to speak. But there's many examples that I have of people essentially, you know, these are young men, but they started racing when they were 12, say.
Right.
And so they hit it hard for 10 years. And then they discovered there's more to life than, you know, mortgaging your entire future to finish top 20 at an NRC race and get paid nothing. But they still like racing here and there. And it is, the point I'm getting to is, it is amazing how well you can do on like 250 hours a year.
Yeah.
Just. And I mean, granted, yes, training history, yes, training experience, blah, blah, blah. But I think, especially as like type A athletes who think you have to check every box or you shouldn't even bother showing up, it's don't make measures the targets. Like, don't worship your training load and feel like if you miss one little detail that you just could not perform. I mean, how some people perform on like just barely putting in the minimum effort or even less, it's just, it'll blow your mind.
Yeah. And I do want to like just add something here. Like, we're not advocating for not training or to like half-ass it or anything like that, but it's like really about fit. Like, don't stress out. Or if you have 6 hours a week to train, then use that 6 hours. But you also have to look at that within the context of your life. And like you said, like, yeah, you might have 12 hours, but that means that you're like super stressed and it's like you're starting to get kitted up as you just drop the kids off to school and like having to hop on the bike and taking calls on while you're riding and stuff like that. And it's like, with that added stress, it's probably not optimal training anyway. So let's get back to the max heart rate. You kind of tested this on yourself first. And so what are the things you noticed in the beginning? And then what is it? Look, how long have you been doing it and what have you seen so far?
Same thing as my athletes. Really struggled because I didn't realize how, I would say, mentally addicted I was to being in a certain place at endurance pace. And so dropping it down, like, it was just a drop down, like just truly pedaling easier.
Yeah, so as an example, like prior to that, what were your endurance pace rides watts wise? And after that, what?
Well, I would try to stay around 140-ish heart rate. And we'll call that, for me, that was like between 240 and 260 watts. So, but that was pretty steady, like zone two maxing. And then I saw this and my zone changed to, the ceiling was like one. I think its ceiling is 132 is the ceiling. So 101 to 132.
Okay.
So I normally park it around 115, 120 now.
131.5.
Yeah, I get the decimal points.
Exactly. Sorry. So repeat that. You like in the middle there, where are you when you're typically riding?
Yeah, I just park it at like 115, 120. Don't stress.
Yeah. And so let me ask you about this, because this is something, like, me personally, I definitely can feel when my heart rate goes over a certain threshold. Like, I can feel it gets more stressful on my heart rate, but the other thing that I'm always paying attention to is the sensation in my legs and what my breathing's doing. And so can you kind of like distinguish between those? Like, what was your breathing like before? What was the tension on your muscles at the higher heart rate versus when you're training at this kind of middle ground now?
I think the breathing it wasn't that much more labored. I would say the biggest indicator for me was just the mental focus required. So kind of getting to the top of, let's say before, 240 to 260, I could do that and fairly easily. My breathing wasn't that labored, but it was zeroed in, lots of mental bandwidth tied up into that. And now there's just, there really isn't. It's just sort of like I'm sending a signal that says, just keep pedaling.
Right.
Yeah. And don't get, I try not to get lazy. I do try to keep my cadence on the screen because I don't want it to drop to whatever, 75. So I try to keep it in the 90s. But just fluid, fast, and just like enjoy myself and enjoy the ride. And stop trying to just like always be cruising up to the top.
Yeah, because just riding the edge.
Whatever.
Yeah. And so what are some of the objective improvements you've seen thus far in your own training and racing?
Well, one big thing for me was, and this is really important from a lifestyle perspective, but I believe that my mood went up and my bandwidth for everything else in my life, just kids and chores and everything just went up a level, I would say.
Yeah.
I had more enthusiasm, more energy. And before I would say chronically, I was just sort of, not out of it, but I just had to exert so much willpower. Like, it just felt, everything felt so much harder than it should. So that was a big one. Another thing that I've noticed is sort of HRV going up. Just in general. I would say last year I was hovering around the 40s and 50s, and now it's high 70s, sometimes 90s. So, and sleep is much better. Intervals are surprising. I'm just finding that the intensity is going better in general. And part of what I think, and this is somewhat related, you know, just to loop it back to the paper, is that there's far more of a difference in my training composition. So I'd say most of the stuff is just like pretty damn easy.
Yeah.
And then, but I'll have on average, like 2 days a week, they're hard, but I mean, when they're hard, they're pretty hard. They're very different than the days around them.
Right.
And overall load and actual, the watts that I'm putting out.
Yeah. That's like, what is the adage? The mediocrity of the middle. And that's typically where people find themselves, right? It's just like kind of hard on your endurance days and harder on your interval days, but the distribution probably isn't that much greater than your typical day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so what are the authors of the paper? What is their kind of a guess as far as the adaptations and why is it different? I mean, aside from bigger training intensity distribution.
They think it's the accumulation of lots of time that's creating kind of like a low adaptive signal. And so that's hurting them. And also just because of the way that you measure intensity. Like, for example, if you're going to go, let's say, the lactate route, that can be helpful, but it introduces a lot of testing rigor. Like, you have to test that a lot.
Yeah.
And you might get the wrong value. You got to do it when you're doing the training. So if you have support and you're really interested in that, well, go for it. But if you're most people, it's not going to happen. And it's very deceiving because, you know, if you do a lactate test, unless you've done your research, there's so many variables that go into it that could, I mean, you could get one value one day and then the next day it's like totally different.
Yeah.
And people are getting one data point and then just saying, well, this is the line in the sand. And it's like, no, it's a pretty big zone. Another big thing they talk about is anaerobic threshold. And this is what we were texting back and forth before. And essentially, rule of thumb, whatever you think your anaerobic threshold is, in cycling, for example, to name a cycling zone, it's probably more like your sweet spot.
Yeah.
It's just lower.
And you and I were talking about this offline where I've been playing with a device that's called Moxie that measures saturation of muscle oxygen or muscle oxygen saturation. And based on that, like what I feel as my threshold, it's way higher than what it shows as my threshold. And I've had the same experience with lactate. And I did a podcast on this recently where you're right. Like there's a lot of, a lot of potential for error when you're doing lactate. And like, if you eat too soon before you do the test, or if you get a little bit of sweat in the test, or like, if you don't get enough blood for the draw, and it can just be a huge pain in the ass. But when I've done lactate, I saw the same thing where if I were to do a 20-minute test, or if I was to ride for 30 minutes at like threshold, it's way harder. And we're talking like 20 to 30 watts harder than my actual metabolic steady state or my lactate steady state. And so if we think about what it is, and I always think about, I did a 10K years ago, and it's like when you start, you know, so it took me like 40 something minutes and I was probably running it at threshold. Well, those first 2 miles didn't feel very hard. You know, those first 12 minutes didn't feel very hard. And so if you're doing 10 minute intervals at threshold and you're struggling to get through the last 2 minutes each time, you're probably not at threshold. If we're talking about an intensity you can hold for 30 to 60 minutes, Like,
yes.
Like, it should be comfortably hard. You shouldn't be like death gripping the bars 5 minutes in trying to complete your 10-minute interval.
Yes. Yeah. And I think another thing that they pointed out is because, you know, when these skiers are training, they don't have a power number to chase. It's very important, like it's an essential skill for them to actually develop a feeling for that effort. Mm-hmm. So they're like and they pointed out the best are amazing as far as like they can say, hey, I did this one and I think I'm at, you know, 3 millimoles.
Right.
And they're at 3 millimoles and they don't go, you know, there are some people, you know, of course, like younger skiers who aren't as experienced who want to prove something in the workout or going off and whatever, they beat them in the workout, but then they're trashed the next day because, you know, to use your example, because what were they doing in that last 2 minutes of the 10-minute interval? They were hanging on. Yeah. And yeah, they can do it, but it's the net, like net training you can adapt to, and you just made that workout so much harder than it was intended to be.
Right. Yeah, and I think it goes back. I mean, this is something I feel like I've talked about a lot recently on the podcast, but it's like, ultimately, it's about consistency, and it's finding workloads that allow you to do the work day in and day out, week in and week out, year after year. That's what leads to continuous improvement, but it's like having these heroic days every now and then that like causes you to take two or three days off because you're so wrecked. You're just like two steps forward, one step back. But if you can just like make those incremental gains, that's going to be way better for you in the long run and more enjoyable.
Yeah. And I think one thing you're saying, but not saying that is key takeaway here is just trying to work out. I call it workout maxing or searching for answers. If that's your mindset and then you like couple that with training a lot, there's a good chance you're effing up, like, and you will not, unless you're really lucky and you have just Zeus's genes and doesn't matter how much stress you throw on and you're 22 with your obligations, maybe you can get away with that for a while. But for most people, it's just going to lay you out. Very seldom do you want to work out max. Mostly you want to have plenty in reserve, feel in control, and then that's enough. Because it really doesn't take, if you're consistent, it really doesn't take that much. Like every day is just a little push.
Yeah.
It's not huge shoves. And I often think back, one of the most frustrating things about my athletic career is like when I started training in 2012, I improved a bit. And then 2013, I just did a massive leap. And in 3 months or so, 4 months, I mean, I just went from cat four power to just like low Conti power. And I never achieved that swing again. And I was like, how did I get that trajectory? And it was because I started dating my wife. And because I had other things going on, I basically need 2 hard workouts a week and the rest like very easy or just, I just skipped.
Yeah.
So I was but I was consistent, but I just could not train as much because I was trying to woo her.
Yeah.
And so even though I was training too hard, you know, I'd have 3 days off. Now, if I had more time to destroy myself, I would do a hard workout and then medium workout, and try again.
Yep.
So I just stumbled into the right rhythm at that point.
Well, and I think that brings up a really good point, and I think this is kind of goes back to your point on workout maximizing or whatever you called it. This idea of recovery rides and just that, right? It's like if you wake up feeling wrecked or what, it's like, I think sometimes it might be good for mental health or if you like it's right now it's spring in Colorado. And so like we're getting some nice days. So it's like, yeah, if you want to go out and enjoy the weather and feel the sun on your skin and just like pedal easy, great. But it's probably not helping you training wise. And you're probably not as recovering as maximally or optimally as you would have been. And so, yeah, it's like a lot of times just like taking time off, especially if you're thinking about it, if you feel like you want to take time off, if you're not motivated to get on the bike, like probably listen to that, like lay on the couch, watch some Netflix, like recover, you know,
everyone listening, bookmark Dave's words right there. if Guaranteed, if you're thinking, I should probably take a day off, you should take a day off because you're a crazy motivated psycho cyclist. And if there's one voice in your head that's contradicting that, that means you're tired.
I love that. I love that.
Just skip.
So with this, like I said, I'll link to the paper. Do you have any other advice for people who want to try this? Where can people find you and any other kind of resources?
Yep. So I'm going to invoke our friend of the pod, Nate Wilson, on this. It's going to be, if you decide to try this, it's going to be a hammer blow to your ego. And because you're just going to be riding easier for your endurance. And the results, this isn't lose 10 pounds with one simple trick. You have to see out, Nate's famous line is, you have to see out the timeline of your plan. So it takes a while to manifest and you have to be consistent.
Yeah.
It's not like you can do three rides at endurance pace by maximum heart rate and then,
this isn't working.
Like, you have to give it 4 or 5 months.
Yeah.
At least. So that's that. Me, I have a website, gravelgodcycling.com. Yeah, my email's on there. Hit me up. I do zero marketing. I just get randos trickling in. Shoot me an email.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for your time. I'm going to give this a try myself. It's funny because I used to do this all the time, but I also kind of got sucked into the trap of I get out there and pretty soon I'm riding like 210, you know, like which is on the high side for me. So, yeah.
I know you have to go soon, but I almost want to reveal a huge training secret that I've been engaging in this year.
Oh, I've got to hear it.
I walk now.
That is so funny.
Exactly what you were, you're talking about athletes wanting to do a recovery ride.
No, that's exactly what I've started doing too. I've got a new puppy and so it's given me a reason to like go take him for a while. It's like, I feel like I want to do something. It's nice outside, but rather than getting kitted up and like doing all the stress, I'm just going to go take him on a walk.
Seriously, just walk because getting ready for a bike ride is annoying. You're going to go out. Somebody's going to pass you. You're going to put in like 1,000-watt dig just to show them what's up. Walking, you'll get your sun. You'll get out of your house or whatever. You can do it anywhere. It's movement. It's chill. Like, just do that.
Yeah. Awesome. I love that. Great, great parting wisdom. Thanks again for your time. And I hope to have you on again soon. Later.